every time too, that's the other thing about it. Tony said he has to go, he has to vote or something like that, but I'm sure we'll all say thank you very much indeed for coming along. He's just going to go and he asked me to say that's why he's going. Now the next speaker, we now, those of us that call the meeting are going to speak in turn, quite briefly, I hope. And the first speaker is Victoria Britton, who is the assistant foreign editor of The Guardian. I'm embarrassed to speak too much about them because my friends, but everyone who reads what she has to say in The Guardian has a profound respect for her, and I want you to give a good hand to Victoria Britton.
Thank you very much. Well, it's a very hard act to follow Tony Benn, but luckily I'm one of the soundbite speakers, so I've only got about 3 minutes. I just want to put the context of our meeting in much the same way as both Paul and Tony have already put it, which is what we're facing now of Western Europe's tolerance of the revival of fascism in mainstream politics. And I want to stress mainstream politics, because that's what's happening. It's already happened in France, and ever since the Italian elections, it's very clearly happened there, and it's very close to happening here. But hand in hand with that rise in fascism is a rise in racism, which in Britain, we have a manifestation of racism across the spectrum. Both the racist violence that Paul already touched upon, which is now becoming commonplace, and also, I just want to refer to the invisible racism, which I think many of our generation take very much for granted. And I particularly want to refer to the scandalous underrepresentation of black people in positions of power. And of course, I must include our own profession in that. Also part of the context, I want to just refer, as Tony did, but in a slightly different way, to the echoes of the 30s. One of the most important things in Britain in the 30s was the Labour weakness, the Labour Party leadership weakness, and that's what led up to the Conservative victory of 1935. In that period, there was a very substantial fight against fascism, but it was a fight that was led as a popular movement by all sorts of people whose names most of us have forgotten. And I want to put our kind of humble effort in having a meeting like this in that context. There are no leaders here. We're just people who wanted to express something that we thought other people wanted to express and hope that together we could make some kind of popular movement. In the 30s, when people had these kind of meetings, they would read out lists, and I've read some of those lists, of the arson attacks on synagogues and on shops held by Jewish people. Well, we could do exactly the same about black people, not only in East London, but all over today. So against this context, as Tony already said, we know why we're here. It's because the role of the media is very, very powerful. It's much more powerful than it's ever been at any previous time. And one of the ways in which it's very powerful is this legitimizing and normalizing of fascist politics. I would particularly note the very respectful, I think Paul used the word sycophantic, but sycophantic or respectful attitude, for instance, to Feeney, who in some curious way has become defined as somebody who isn't really a fascist. If you read his program, or if you go to Rome at the moment, you'll find fascist slogans, fascist signals, signs all over the walls, graffiti everywhere. It's real fascism. It's not some kind of designer thing that's somehow different and kind of all right. Similarly, this, as Tony already referred to the treatment of Alexandra Mussolini as some kind of exotic, rather sort of jokey thing. It's not jokey, it's highly serious, and it's real fascism. The same thing goes for what I call the new face of British fascism. They're wearing suits now, too, at least they wear them when they come on the telly, putting forward this same kind of moderation And I think the role of the media, and particularly television and radio, in putting forward this moderation as somehow acceptable is something that we have to work really hard to break. They're not legitimate, they're not moderate, and they shouldn't be there. Of course, the reason that we see them on the television, and we see them in The Independent and other places, is in the name of something that anyone who's been to journalism school knows. It's called balance. Now, balance, in my view, is a very convenient myth. It's a kind of news editor's excuse for not having a view on anything, or not bothering with history or with context. But it's this word balance is turned into a kind of shibboleth. Nobody can challenge it because it's, by definition, it's good. And just to illustrate what I think about balance, I want to tell you a cautionary tale from another continent. It's a tale which also illustrates the tenacity and the hidden allies of fascism, and in a way illustrates exactly what Tony was talking about from another point of view. It's nearly 20 years since Portuguese fascism collapsed in Europe, and it collapsed because in its colonies, particularly in Angola and Mozambique, a very strong popular movement challenged it militarily. In both those countries, the liberation movements which came to power after fighting fascism for decades found themselves confronted on the morning after they'd got power by the people who had been the indigenous allies of the Portuguese army, UNITA in Angola and RENAMO in Mozambique. With hindsight, and able to read the memoirs of the CIA agent John Stockwell, who was the leader of the CIA task force in Angola, and the excellent book by Ken Flower, the Rhodesian Secret Service chief in the same period, we can find exactly what they thought of the pathetic, disorganized little bands that they were expected to form into some kind of resistance. In fact, so pathetic and disorganized were those two groups that they needed South African troops on the ground. And in the case of Angola, they needed American aid in very, very large quantities, both in terms of dollars and in terms of the American network of Zaire, Morocco, Kenya, and various other countries to put up some resistance to the anti-fascists who'd taken power. But 15 years in the name of balance, the Western media has been reporting that what they call two sides are engaged or were engaged in what they call a civil war. The monstrousness of this campaign, and if you ever go back and look at what has been written over that period, over these two cases, in these two cases, you see the complete abdication of the journalist's real function, which is to report what's happening, to attempt to find out what's happening and explain it to people so that they can understand our world. That function was completely abdicated in favour of what was a kind of balancing act of the what was called the claims of both sides. And I find it interesting what Tony said about the American ambassador's view on Mussolini, because it's almost exactly the same words as in another memoir, the very interesting one by Chester Crocker, what he has to say about Savimbi, who he wrote in a book which was published, embarrassingly, would have thought for him, only a year or so ago. He described him as the most charismatic and important democratic leader for Africa. This balance is, of course, quite selective. And the way that it worked in the two cases that I'm talking about meant that all the well-authenticated stories about how Savimbi organized social control in Angola by one of the devices used was burning women as witches. This, of course, was never allowed to appear in the Western press because it was thought to be unbalanced and probably communist propaganda. And on the same way in Mozambique, all the stories of the child soldiers and the atrocities against the civilian population always had to be balanced by stories about government corruption. This somehow made everybody feel calm. They were just two bad sides fighting against each other. Now today, that balance, that media balance, has been part of the political process which has brought us to a situation in both those countries. These two puppet organisations, as they were, are on the bridge, on the brink of taking a very substantial shape of part of power. And when I see Mr. Daklama, the leader of RENAMU, who also has a nice suit these days, although 5 years ago they didn't even dare show him to Western journalists. He always had to be hidden away in the bush because he hadn't yet been groomed by people to appear on television. He now appears on Newsnight and is treated as a perfectly normal politician. And the idea that he may even not have to have an election because he just might manage not to win it, it's normal and legitimate. And the attitude of the journalists who write these reports or do these television interviews is exactly the same as everything Paul said about The Independent and The Economist and everything that you've seen yourself if you've watched these programs like the one in which Enoch Powell and somebody called Mr. Bean of the BNP were interviewed in what I thought was one of the most scandalously shoddy, sloppy pieces of mainstream television that I've ever had to see. And I hope that if there's anybody here who worked on that kind of program and they weren't embarrassed before, I hope that being at this kind of meeting will make them feel that they don't really want to do that kind of work anymore. Thank you.